KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump wants to end federal funding for NPR and PBS. It's his latest attack on public media. He also tried to fire three Corporation for Public Broadcasting board members. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Texas judge appointed by Trump says the president's use of the Alien Enemies Act to deport migrants is unlawful. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadil. The judge says the law applies to military invasions, not the activities of a gang Trump now calls a terrorist organization. Also, a survivor of the Kent State shooting remembers 55 years later. And shopping online at Chinese retailers gets a lot more expensive today as tariffs on packages worth less than $800 kick in. It's Friday, May 2nd. On this day in 2000, the federal government stopped limiting GPS accuracy outside the military. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Labor Department reported somewhat stronger job growth in April than forecasters expected. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 320 points in early trading.
Job growth slowed last month, but not as much as analysts had feared as President Trump's worldwide tariffs went into effect. U.S. employers added 177,000 jobs in April. That's down only slightly from the previous month. The unemployment rate held steady at 4.2%, even as more than 500,000 people joined or rejoined the workforce. Jobs were added in healthcare, restaurants, and construction in April, while retailers and factories cut workers last month. The federal government also cut about 9,000 jobs, but that was more than offset by job gains in state and local government. The labor market has held up well in recent months, even as the overall U.S. economy has showed some signs of weakness. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is expected to release a proposed summary of his budget later today. NPR has learned it cuts about $163 billion from discretionary spending that's not related to defense spending. The proposal does not include federal spending on safety nets such as Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That's expected to be shown later in a full budget proposal. The president is removing National Security Advisor Mike Waltz and nominating him instead as U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Waltz admitted he was the one who mistakenly added a journalist to a group chat discussing U.S. military strikes in Yemen. NPR's Franco Ordonez says that close Trump aides didn't fully trust Waltz.
And we've seen Trump lean more heavily on other aides when it comes to big conflicts in Ukraine and Gaza, and even in talks with Iran. Those included Rubio, as well as the Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff, and even Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
NPR's Franco Ordonez reporting. Israel has launched airstrikes near the Syrian presidential palace in Damascus. The bombing follows days of clashes involving fighters from a Syrian religious minority and government security forces. NPR's Jana Raff has details.
The strike before dawn Friday was the second Israeli attack in 2 days in Syria. Israel's defense minister said the latest bombing was a message to the Syrian president that Israel is determined to protect the Druze, a religious minority also present in Israel. And it warned the Syrian government not to deploy its own troops in southern Syria. Israel has launched airstrikes and seized more territory in Syria's southwest since the fall of the Syrian regime last year. The Druze faith is an offshoot of Shia Islam. Clashes between Druze militias, Sunni Arab militants, and government security forces in Druze areas in southwestern Syria have killed dozens of people this week. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up about 400 points. This is NPR. President Trump has signed an executive order targeting federal funding for public broadcasting. It prohibits local public radio and television stations and any other recipients of funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting from using taxpayer dollars. In a statement, the CPB says it is not subject to the president's authority. President Trump accuses NPR and PBS of left-wing political bias. The writer Ksenia Lubrin has won this year's Carol Shields Prize. NPR's Andrew Limbong reports the award honors women and non-binary fiction writers in the U.S. and Canada.
Kinesia Lubrin is a Canadian writer known more for her poetry. Her debut fiction book, Code Noir, won her the prize, though. It's a collection of 59 connected short stories taking inspiration from French King Louis XIV's laws legalizing and regulating slavery in France and the French colonies. Judges for the Carol Shields Prize called it a, quote, virtuoso collection that breaks new ground in short fiction. The Carol Shields Prize for Fiction is relatively new, but it's made an impact on the literary world because of its sheer size. Winners get $150,000. In comparison, winners of the National Book Award receive $10,000. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
The U.S. Geological Survey says there's been an exceptionally powerful earthquake south of the southern tip of Chile. It's in a body of water called the Drake Passage. It also borders Antarctica. The quake's magnitude was 7.5, and there is the possibility of tsunami waves. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll find out why lots of orders from Chinese retailers are getting more expensive starting today. But first...
Late last night, President Trump issued an executive order that attempts to end federal funding for NPR and PBS, accusing the organizations of political bias.
It's the latest in a string of attacks on public media by the administration and Republican leaders in Congress. The move bans direct federal funding for the public broadcasters. It also bans local public radio and television stations from using taxpayer dollars to support them. Under NPR's protocol for reporting on itself, no NPR executive reviewed the story before it airs.
With us to talk about all of this is NPR's Ryland Barton. Hi, Ryland.
Hi, Leila.
So tell us exactly how Trump is trying to defund NPR and PBS through this executive order.
Well, Trump is directing the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, to stop sending money to NPR and PBS, saying that federal funding should not support what he calls biased and partisan news coverage. NPR and PBS have repeatedly said they are fair in their coverage. CPB is this independent nonprofit created by Congress in 1967 to partially fund public broadcasters. And currently, NPR receives about 1% of its funding directly from CPB, and PBS gets about 15%. But the other part of this executive order tries to get at the indirect ways that the news organizations get federal dollars, and that's through local stations. They are banned from using CPB funds to pay for NPR or PBS content under the order. Now, I should say, CPB is also fighting a different move by the president earlier this week to fire board members, so it's unclear how they will respond to this order. They sued, saying they're not a federal agency and that board members don't serve at the pleasure of the president.
Okay, so what have NPR and PBS said about this executive order and what they plan to do?
So not a whole lot so far, but in a statement, NPR said that the Constitution gives the power to Congress over these funding decisions, not the president, and that the executive order will, quote, have a devastating impact on local communities across America that rely on public radio for trusted local and national news, life-saving emergency alerts, and public safety information.
Okay, this appears to be the most direct attack on public media, but we all know this has been building for a while.
Yeah, Layla, listeners might remember that back in late March, the heads of NPR and PBS testified at this House hearing called Anti-American Airwaves, holding the heads of NPR and PBS accountable. It was headed up by Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. Here she is speaking to NPR CEO Catherine Marr.
Let me inform you, and that so that your federal funding is also paid for by the other half of the country. The 77 million Americans who voted for President Trump, someone you called a deranged, racist sociopath.
Green was referring to a social media post Marr made before she became NPR CEO. Mm-hmm. Marr said she regretted the post and wouldn't have made it today. And Marr and her PBS counterpart rejected accusations that their coverage is biased.
Okay, tell us about how this would affect local stations.
Yeah, so stations like Louisville Public Media, where I happen to be based and I'm sitting right now, yeah, they get an average of 8% to 10% of their revenue from CPB. That number is much, much higher for smaller rural stations, sometimes over 50% of their funding. Stations have been sounding the alarm on this in recent months. You can hear it in their fund drives saying it's an existential threat to their operations and their communities. And it's unclear what this executive order means for them, but a lot of content on stations is national NPR and PBS programming. NPR relies on these member stations to cover breaking news and provide context that national reporters just can't always do. And they're sometimes the only news option for people in remote places, providing life-saving emergency alerts about things like severe weather.
NPR's Ryland Barton. Thank you, Ryland.
Thank you.
In a statement, CPB said that it is, quote, not a federal executive agency subject to the president's authority. Congress directly authorized and funded CPB to be a private nonprofit corporation wholly independent of the federal government. The head of PBS is now calling the executive order blatantly unlawful.
A lot of Americans turn to Chinese platforms like Temu and Shein, searching for a good deal on just about everything, household goods, gardening supplies, clothes. But starting today, those orders are going to get a lot more expensive because the U.S. will start charging tariffs on low-value packages coming from China. With us to tell us more about this is NPR's Emily Fang. Good morning, Emily.
Hey, Michelle.
So would you just start by explaining what is changing?
Right. So up until today, your order for whatever you wanted, you know, a super cheap bike bell or sparkly pants from a Chinese site, they could be shipped into the U.S. for free as long as your order was under $800. And this was under something called a de minimis exemption. Originally, it was meant to save the government money if the cost of collecting a tax was more than the tax itself. But now, if you order from China, you will need to pay an import fee that's either calculated per item or up to 145% of the total value of your order. And so I've been talking to shocked customers in the U.S. who have noticed on a site like Temu, for example, that their total shopping costs have more than doubled over the last week. And I know there's been a lot of tariff news, but the end of this particular exemption is one of the new taxes that is going to affect U.S. consumers pretty immediately and directly.
Why is the Trump administration closing this loophole?
So it's not just the Trump administration. There's been pressure to close the de minimis exemption starting under the Biden administration, and both administrations have proposed limiting this loophole for China. And their argument has been the exemption was great if you're the consumer and you're a bargain hunter, but it's not great for U.S. businesses who cannot compete with such low prices, or for the U.S. government, which was missing out on revenue by not taxing these packages. U.S. Customs say that the number of these packages have gone from just over about 150 million 8 years ago to over 1 billion a year last year, and that's completely overwhelmed U.S. Customs. They can only screen a tiny fraction of these packages. They're looking for things like counterfeit products or items potentially made with forced labor or banned substances like fentanyl.
So if you're looking to order something from China right now, or maybe you have an order already on the way, what should you expect?
I've been talking to trade enforcement experts, and all of them are saying to expect massive snarls in shipping and long delays in delivery times. Ram Bensian is one of those experts I spoke to. He's the CEO of one of these digital enforcement companies called Ultra, and he explains now everyone in this shipping supply chain is going to be impacted. So that includes customs brokers that now have to fill out new paperwork required for every small package being sent to the U.S. about, you know, where this package is coming from, what's in it. And it will also impact the U.S. government, which needs to suddenly step up screening for all of these millions and millions of packages coming in.
Now, everything needs to go through a formal entry process. It is beyond the capacity of consumers, logistic operators, carriers, who until yesterday were not liable to anything or near anything.
Actually, in February, if you remember, the U.S. Postal Service briefly did float the idea of collecting import taxes on low-value packages from China. They implemented that for a few days. It created such a huge buildup of packages that were waiting to be screened at U.S. ports that they actually retracted the import fee soon after.
That is NPR's Emily Fang. Emily, thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Outside the Supreme Court yesterday, hundreds of attorneys rallied to support the rule of law. President Trump and his allies in Congress have attacked federal judges who ruled against him and threatened law firms over the lawyers they've hired and clients they've represented. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports on a notable new law firm emerging this week.
Over nearly 40 years of legal practice, Abby Lowell has seen a lot. He's represented the son of former President Biden and the son-in-law of President Trump. He's defended members of Congress and super lobbyists. Now Lowell's doing something new. He's starting his own small law firm.
Our first and foremost obligation will always be to zealously represent an individual client. But by zealously representing an individual client, if we can be a force to strengthen the overall rule of law, that's what it's about.
Lately, some of the individuals Lowell has been representing have drawn the ire of the current president. That list includes New York's Democratic Attorney General Letitia James, who investigated the Trump Organization, former Trump administration staffer Miles Taylor, who wrote a tell-all book about it, and lawyer Mark Zaid, who represents whistleblowers. Again, Abby Lowell.
We are not a partisan firm. We're not trying to make a political statement. What we're trying to do is respond to the moment, which is very different than it's been.
One difference is the attention on law firms, which have themselves been targets of Trump's executive action. Trump says these firms are abusing the legal system and pursuing baseless partisan attacks. Some of those firms are fighting his orders in court. Many others are striking deals with the White House. The president talked about some of those deals in an interview with ABC News this week.
These are the most powerful firms in the world, and they just signed whatever I put in front of them. I've never seen anything like it. I'm actually surprised myself in a certain way.
The settlements have been controversial, including among young lawyers. Two of them, Rachel Cohen and Brenna Trout Frey, used to work at the Skadden firm, but they resigned recently as Skadden agreed to do $100 million of pro bono work with Trump in March. Now Lowell says they're joining his new law firm. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, Shipwreck, Mutiny, and Murder. We talk with David Gran about his nonfiction book, The Wager, investigating the crash of an 18th century British warship. The survivors sailed thousands of miles to safety on a makeshift boat and faced charges of mutiny. Gran also wrote Killers of the Flower Moon. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Federal employees at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs are facing a deadline Monday. They have to report to work in person. Some, especially mental health clinicians, are objecting. They say VA offices won't give them the privacy they need to do their jobs. NPR's Kadia Riddle reports.
Every day for the last few months, Dee has been reporting in person to work. His office is about 15 by 15 feet. Dee is a middle initial. He didn't want to use his name or location for fear of reprisals from the VA.
So there are three of us that work together in the office. There's a physician assistant, a psychologist, and myself.
Dee works in HR. He regularly discusses sensitive information on the phone. The clinicians are doing telehealth. He can't hear the patients on the other end of the calls, but he can't help but hear his colleagues who are sitting in the same room.
I do hear the psychologist mirroring back or summarizing what they say, and none of us in the room like that we can hear all of that. And I myself am a veteran, and I wouldn't like any of that repeated back, knowing there was somebody else in the room. And it's just, it's not good.
Not good and possibly not legal. Federal privacy laws guarantee patient confidentiality. Lynn Bufka is with the American Psychological Association. She says patient privacy is tantamount to quality care.
That's just such a fundamental way that psychological services, psychotherapy has been conducted that I think most people feel sort of like, why would we even need to say that so explicitly?
The quality of the bond between a patient and provider is one of the key indicators of effective therapy. Bufka says without it, patients are compromised.
They may be less likely to disclose some of the things that are of most importance, or they may not even return for continued treatment.
NPR interviewed more than a dozen VA mental health care providers about this topic. Most of them didn't want to speak on the record. Many voiced a widespread concern that VA facilities just don't have the space for all mental health staff to work in person and have privacy. A therapist who asked to be identified only by her middle name, Lynn, for fear of retribution from the VA, says she's been thinking about her own red lines. She's decided she will not hold therapy sessions if she can't guarantee confidentiality.
I will not violate the law as well as the professional ethics.
Some mental health clinicians have been granted last-minute or temporary exemptions from the return-to-work order. But Lynn and others say the VA has not given them a long-term guarantee of necessary patient privacy.
It's not safe for anyone, particularly in mental health, where the things they're sharing with us are very sensitive and personal and intimate and scary for them.
In an email response to a request for comment on this story, VA spokesperson Peter Kasparowitz wrote, quote, VA will extend current telework and remote work arrangements beyond the May 5 deadline when appropriate space is not available, unquote. Lynn says she is not reassured. The inconsistency and intermittent communication about her future is stressing her out.
It keeps your cortisol levels up so high, it's unhealthy.
And, she says, it's interfering with her ability to be a good therapist to veterans. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Time now for StoryCorps. This weekend marks 55 years since National Guardsmen opened fire on students protesting the Vietnam War at Kent State University in Ohio. 4 students were killed. Among the wounded were best friends Thomas Grace and Alan Canfora. Canfora died in 2020, but Grace recently came to StoryCorps to remember him. He spoke with Canfora's sister, Chick, a Kent State sophomore at the time.
My most vivid memory was waking up in my dormitory and looking up my 4th floor window. I used to watch football games out the window, and that field was filled with military jeeps, small tanks, and tents. It resembled a war zone, and that was where we would be gathering in just a couple of hours for a peaceful anti-war protest. I knew that the soldiers were not there to protect me.
What I remember the most are the 2 cracks of the M1 rifles. I turned and I started to run as fast as I could.
Someone grabbed my arm and pulled me behind a car. The glass was shattering out of the windows and bullets were coming through the steel bodies of the cars. The most vivid recollection through that long, horrifying 13 seconds behind that car was knowing that all those people, including you and my brother, Alan, were out there in the wide open.
I don't think I got more than 3 or 4 steps. And before I knew it, I was on the ground and the bullet had entered my left heel and it took off the right side of my left foot. I was trying to sit up and then I heard someone yelling to me, "Stay down, stay down." And I looked over and it was Alan.
Alan was shot in the wrist and the bullet went in one side and out the other. He told me why he thinks he survived that day. Did I ever tell you that?
No, you didn't.
He told me that when we were children, he always imagined there was someone in the basement who was shooting at him. And so he would run back and forth in a zigzag all the way up the steps, missing the bullets each time. He remembered that game he played as a child when he heard the gunfire, and he zigzagged to the right, to the left.
It saved his life.
Yeah.
You and I haven't done this for 30 years. I've told you many times before how much I truly value your friendship. That's only deepened since we lost Alan.
When he died so suddenly, you were the first I called, before I called anyone in my family.
Chick, your brother was a tough guy, and I was always grateful that he was my best friend.
You were best friends, and we were sister and brother, conjoined by tragedy in a way that is as strong a bond as twins might have been. And I can't imagine a greater privilege than to take Alan's place as your best friend.
Chick Canfora and Thomas Grace at StoryCorps. Their conversation is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru. The new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank. Part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. And from Dignity Memorial, pre-planning a celebration of life can allow more time to focus on life's little moments. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at DignityMemorial.com.
This is NPR News.
President Trump has repeatedly brought up the danger of harmful chemicals, but now his administration is dismantling an agency that spends much of its energy on that work, leaving research lost or abandoned.
We don't have access to any of the data. We don't have access to anything.
I'm Elsa Chang. The cuts to occupational health research on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Labor Department says employers in the U.S. added 177,000 jobs in April. That's more than were forecast by economists, though it marked a slowdown in hiring from March. President Trump is expected to propose $163 billion in cuts to non-defense discretionary funding today. That's according to an official with the White House Office of Management and Budget, not authorized to speak publicly. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben says the cuts will be part of the president's summary budget.
Budget experts have told me that this budget may be more meaningful than usual. Trump not only has Republican majorities in both houses, albeit slim majorities, he also has a stranglehold on the GOP. He's remade the party. He throws his weight around in primaries, and members of Congress know that.
This preliminary budget does not include spending for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. The CEO of Apple says President Trump's tariffs could cost the company close to $1 billion in the latest quarter.
Assuming the current global tariff rates, policies, and applications do not change for the balance of the quarter, and no new tariffs are added, we estimate the impact to add $900 million to our costs.
That's Apple CEO Tim Cook. This is NPR News from Washington. President Trump continues to move aggressively to scale back traditional U.S. leadership roles around the world. Here's NPR's Greg Myrie.
In his first 100 days, Trump is acting on multiple fronts to reshape the U.S. role in the world. He says Europe should stop depending on U.S. troops for its security. He repeatedly criticizes allies and has threatened or imposed tariffs on many friendly countries. Kelly Grieco is with the Stimson Center, a nonpartisan think tank.
He's really taking a sledgehammer approach to U.S. foreign policy and the institutions around it.
Trump is often dismissive of institutions the U.S. helped build, including the United Nations and NATO. He describes this network of international bodies as obstacles that often prevent the U.S. from acting decisively on its own. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
State police in Illinois say the driver of a car that slammed into a building this week, killing three children and an 18-year-old at an after-school program, was not under the influence of drugs and may have had a medical emergency. The 44-year-old driver has not been charged. That crash occurred in Chatham, near Springfield. The children killed were 7 and 8 years old. Stocks on Wall Street are higher this morning. The Dow's up 447 points, or more than 1%. The NASDAQ is up 220 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. A federal judge says that President Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act to deport Venezuelan immigrants is unlawful.
It's the first ruling of its kind. The decision comes from U.S. District Judge Fernando Rodriguez Jr. in South Texas. I'll note he was appointed by President Trump, and this ruling is a blow to the president's efforts to remove migrants from the country.
NPR's immigration correspondent Sergio Martinez Beltran has been following the case and joins me now. Hi, Sergio.
Good morning.
Good morning. So can you tell us more about this case and the ruling from Judge Rodriguez?
Yes, so the men in this Texas case have been threatened with imminent removal under the Alien Enemies Act. It's never been used in the way the Trump administration has. The men are accused of being members of Tren de Aragua, a Venezuelan gang, and they're currently in detention at El Valle Detention Center in Raymondville, Texas. Now, U.S. District Judge Fernando Rodriguez Jr. wrote in his ruling that Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act exceeds the scope of the statute. The government, he ruled, does not possess the lawful authority under the Alien Enemies Act to detain Venezuelan immigrants or remove them from the country.
Okay, so if the government doesn't have the authority to do it, well, they've already done it. They've used the act to remove people.
Right. I mean, Trump has used the act to remove more than 130 Venezuelan men from the U.S. and send them to a maximum security prison in El Salvador. The administration has accused all of them of being Tren de Aragua, but government officials have conceded not all of the Venezuelans have criminal records. Other courts have sought to block the Trump administration from deporting individuals under the act, but this is the first time a judge has ruled that Trump's use of the act is unlawful. And it all comes down to language and also evidence.
How does that work?
Well, Leila, President Trump issued a proclamation in March accusing the Tren de Aragua gang of, quote, perpetrating, attempting, and threatening an invasion or predatory incursion against the territory of the United States. Judge Rodriguez did an extensive analysis of the historical record, and he concluded the ordinary meaning of invasion or predatory inclusion when the Alien Enemies Act was enacted in 1798 required a military incursion or a hostile takeover. Mm-hmm. He found that the criminal activities of Tren de Aragua members described in Trump's proclamation, while harmful, did not amount to an invasion or predatory incursion as understood under the act. Judge Rodriguez wrote that Trump's proclamation does not suggest an armed group is trying to take over the U.S.
So what does this mean for the men named in this lawsuit?
Yeah, so the lawsuit names three Venezuelan men, but they're also representatives of a bigger class action. Here's the lead counsel for the men, the ACLU's Lee Gelernt.
This decision protects everyone who's detained in the Southern District of Texas. It means that they cannot be removed anywhere under the Alien Enemies Act, much less to a brutal Salvadoran prison.
And that's an important point here, Leila. This decision only applies to the Southern District of Texas, which includes Brownsville, McAllen, and Houston.
So what's next in this case?
Well, the Department of Homeland Security did not respond to a request for comment, but it's almost guaranteed that the Trump administration will appeal this decision. The ACLU is certainly expecting that. If they do so, the appeal would go to the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is considered one of the country's most conservative courts.
That's NPR Sergio Martinez-Beltran. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Federal health officials want new testing rules for vaccines. Vaccine experts are worried that these rules will make it harder for the public to get access to some shots, including the next versions of COVID-19 boosters. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein is with us now to tell us more about this. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, Michelle.
So what's this new requirement?
The Department of Health and Human Services says all new vaccines must be compared to a placebo, you know, a harmless, inactive substance like saline. The new administration says this is necessary to make sure all new vaccines are safe. Now, officials are being kind of cagey about whether this would apply to the next tweaks to the COVID vaccines, but they're indicating that it would, and that's causing a lot of concern among vaccine experts. I talked about this with Dr. Peter Hotez at the Baylor College of Medicine. He thinks this is another attempt by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to undermine vaccines.
He appears to be on full-on attack mode when it comes to vaccines, and it's so self-defeating for our country and globally as well. It's dangerous.
Hotez says it's especially dangerous right now because vaccination rates are so low, measles is causing outbreaks around the country, and COVID is still making lots of people sick, sometimes, you know, really sick. And Hotez says Kennedy has been doing lots of things to undermine confidence in vaccines and complicate their approval, like launching a new study looking at vaccines in autism, even though any connection like that has been debunked.
But this whole thing about placebos, but isn't that the way that most new vaccines, new drugs and vaccines are evaluated anyway, so why is that unreasonable?
Yeah, Yeah, absolutely, Michelle. And that's kind of what's puzzling many scientists. The administration is saying that the vaccines kids routinely get weren't compared to placebos, and that's just not true. Most were. And the same goes for the COVID vaccines. They were all tested against placebos and found to be very safe and effective. And all the vaccines that people get are continuously monitored to make sure they're safe. There's a bunch of problems with demanding that all new shots go through yet another big placebo study. First of all, experts say it's just not always necessary. The next COVID shots, for example, aren't really new vaccines. They're just modified versions of the original vaccines. They'll be tweaked to target the latest strains and provide the best protection, just like the flu vaccines have been getting tweaked every year for decades. Any new placebo study would have to be huge, and that means it would cost a lot of money and take a long time. In fact, critics say it would probably take too long for the vaccines to be available in time for next fall. I talked about this with Dr. Paul Offit at the University of Pennsylvania.
What the administration is arguing for is a trial that will make the vaccine no more safe, no more effective, and all it will do is make it arguably more expensive and less available in a timely manner.
Offit and others also argue it would be unethical to give people a useless placebo for a potentially deadly disease when they could be getting a vaccine that has been clearly shown to be safe and very effective.
So what does the administration say about all this?
So in a statement, HHS spokesman Andrew Nixon says that the existing methods for guaranteeing the safety of vaccines are inadequate, and the technology that's used for the COVID vaccines hasn't been around for the decades like the technology used to make flu vaccines. He also argues that it's necessary to restore public trust in vaccines. He says, quote, "The public deserves transparency and gold standard science, especially with evolving products," unquote.
That's NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Rob, thank you.
You bet, Michelle.
This is NPR News.
If you spend your leisure time scrolling social media, being bored at home, well, Arthur Brooks says you're doing it wrong. What kinds of time off actually make us happier? Next time, here and now.
You wait for the bus, you wait for the weekend, your morning coffee to finish brewing. Well, you don't have to wait to get live news from NPR. Go to this station's website or npr.org on your phone.
Good morning, I'm Layla Faldin. Listening to songs like Boogie Wonderland, you can't help but bob your head to the beat. While you're not the only one, Ronan the Sea Lion is famous for rocking out to songs like this. Scientists had long thought that only humans could recognize a beat, but Ronan can not only do it, she can do it better. A new study pitted her against 10 college students. They played tempos that Ronan had never heard before. The students couldn't keep up with the head-bobbing master. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. The 151st Kentucky Derby is tomorrow at Churchill Downs in Louisville. The race concludes the return of a legendary but controversial trainer. Molly Rollins from racing industry publication The Blood Horse is here to tell us more. Good morning, Molly.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. So let's start with that trainer, Bob Baffert. Who is this guy and why is he coming back?
So Bob Baffert is the best known and arguably the most controversial figure in horse racing. His horse, Medina Spirit, was disqualified from the 2021 Kentucky Derby after testing positive for betamethasone, an anti-inflammatory that was found in a post-race drug test. Churchill Downs did ultimately suspend Bob Baffert from competing in the Kentucky Derby or at any Churchill Downs on track for 3 years. So he has served his time. But in the same breath, he's also the most decorated trainer of the modern era. He's won 6 Kentucky Derbies and 2 Triple Crowns.
Wow. So what are people saying about his return, though?
He's definitely facing a lot of scrutiny from the media. But I think overall, the vibe is people are excited to see him back at Churchill Downs. And he has a live horse in the race. And if he wins 7 Kentucky Derbies, he'll accomplish a feat that no trainer has ever done in racing before. It'll be a truly remarkable feat.
So Churchill Downs shut down for part of 2023 after several horses died. Are we seeing fewer catastrophic injuries and deaths in horse racing these days?
Yes, we are. And Churchill Downs 2023 was a dark time for the track. But since then, they have instituted a few different changes. They've spent a lot of working on the surface. They've added 2,000 tons of dirt to the surface the past few years to create a better cushion and safer surface for the horses. There's also a lot greater veterinary scrutiny by Churchill and their state vet teams. Horses that are actually competing in the Kentucky Derby and the Kentucky Oaks, the filly equivalent, are now required to be on the grounds a week before the race so that their morning exercise can be under the observation of veterinarians. And these changes have so far proved effective. There were no breakdowns during the Derby week last year, and fingers crossed we have another safe Derby week this year.
Is there a clear favorite to win?
There is a clear favorite. The horse you mentioned earlier, Journalism.
I love when Journalism wins, Molly.
Yeah, what a great name. He's 2 for 2 this year. He's won both his prep races out in California. It's really hard to knock him. I've seen him in person a few times this week. He's just a big, beautiful horse. This is really his race to lose.
Okay, so those are the odds. Who's your pick to win the Derby?
So there's a few horses I like. And to me, the best parts of the Derby are just learning all the storylines of the different contenders and their connections. And there are definitely some interesting storylines in this year's Derby. One horse is Burnham Square. I wrote a recent feature for him in Blood Horse. He is a gelding, so he's a horse that's not intact, and only 9 geldings have ever won the Kentucky Derby, the last being in 2009. Another horse is Sandman, who is probably one of the most popular horses on the Derby trail right now. He's named after the Metallica song Enter Sandman. Metallica's actually sent Metallica gear to the horse's connections this week. And he's also owned in partnership by TikTok star Griffin Johnson.
Okay. Well, that's Molly Rollins of The Blood Horse. Thank you so much for that preview, Molly.
My pleasure.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Thank you.
America's labor market in the month just ended, still not bad.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance offers personalized rates and customizable coverages for your business vehicles. More at ProgressiveCommercial.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. The hiring and unemployment reports came in this morning. 177,000 more people were on payrolls in April compared to March. Now, that's more than expected, but less than the increase a month earlier, and some earlier tallies were revised downward. From a house-to-house survey, the percentage of people working remained steady, with the unemployment rate holding at 4.2%, pretty low. Economist Julia Coronado at Macro Policy Perspectives just looked at the numbers. Julia, with all this tariff to-ing and fro-ing, how's the labor market looking?
It's still looking pretty solid. These are very decent job numbers, a low unemployment rate, so the wheels are not coming off the U.S. economy. We do see some spots of weakness. Manufacturing lost 1,000 jobs. Federal government laid off 9,000 workers. But we still have plenty of job creation in other sectors.
9,000 people. It's terrible if you're one of the 9,000, but I would have thought that number would be bigger given all the budget and program cutting we're seeing.
That's right. The BLS actually clarified that a lot of people who are on paid administrative leave do not show up as job losses in this report. So the numbers perhaps understate the job losses in the federal sector, for sure.
Might show up in, for instance, May. Now, our central bankers are meeting next week on interest rates. How will this report play in, do you think?
Well, I think this tells the Fed that they definitely don't need to be in a hurry to make any rash decisions about policy. We are not falling off a cliff, so they don't need to cut interest rates, especially when they anticipate we may get a burst of inflation from tariffs. So this is a steady-as-she-goes report for the Fed.
All right. Economist Julia Coronado is a professor at the University of Texas, Austin, as well. Checking the markets, the Dow is up 411 points, 1%. The S&P and the NASDAQ are each up 1.2%. The 10-year interest rate is up at 4.29% is the figure I see. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has sent an open letter to President Trump arguing tariffs pose a significant risk to jobs and may soon do, quote, irreparable harm to many small businesses. The chamber, which lobbies for firms large and small, is urging the White House now to lift tariffs on items it says cannot be made in the U.S. and to automatically exempt small companies. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that.
Nicola Perry has been running her British restaurant and shop, Tea and Sympathy, in New York City for more than 30 years. She imports almost everything: baked beans, clotted cream, teas, teapots.
We've already had lots of emails from purveyors saying the prices are going to go up because of the tariffs.
Which means she'll have to raise prices for her customers. She plans on telling them why.
Sorry, guys, but the tariffs is costing us X amount, so we're sharing it out amongst everybody. Otherwise, we won't be here.
In Brooklyn, Mitchell Spitzik is worried his shop, Little Things Toy Store, might not be there much longer. Almost everything he sells comes from China.
We are seriously considering all options in terms of what we need to do to survive.
Namely, trying to stock up on extra inventory that's already arrived in the U.S. to keep prices down and make sure he doesn't end up with empty shelves. He's applied for a home equity line of credit. If he gets it,
I can start stocking up for the holidays, but if I don't get that loan, I won't have holiday merchandise, possibly.
If he doesn't have enough, he's not sure the shop can survive. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
The U.S. administration wants to make it easier to fire federal workers among the 50,000 layoffs that could follow. Some who work at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, an office that calculates economic data that business, investors, and the government rely upon, such as today's jobs report. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics releases the monthly jobs report, the Consumer Price Index, the Producer Price Index, economists' bread and butter.
These statistics help us understand which metro areas across the country are growing faster or are losing jobs.
Economist Jed Kolko was an undersecretary at the Commerce Department in the Biden administration. He's worried that the proposed rule could sweep economists at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS, into a new job category, workers who can be fired at will without the usual appeals process. Kolko is worried that it could be harder for BLS economists worried about losing their jobs to deliver bad news, and that
might cause them to face pressure to change a methodology or change the way numbers are presented in order to look more favorable to the administration.
Erica Groshen, a former BLS commissioner now at Cornell, says, for example, if the statistics look bad for the Trump administration, BLS
could discover some glitch in the way the numbers were calculated and say we have to withhold it until we're sure that the numbers are right.
Groshen says ultimately people could lose faith in the quality of BLS data. I reached out to the BLS for comment on all of this, but didn't hear back by deadline. I did talk to Judge Glock at the Manhattan Institute, a right-leaning think tank. He says these are valid concerns, but he thinks BLS economists would resist pressure to manipulate data, even if they could be fired more easily, because their professional reputations would be at risk.
If one of them manipulates data clearly, that person, even if they were rewarded internally, will likely have a tough time for the rest of their life finding a good position.
And Glock says even if a BLS economist in the new job category were fired, they would be replaced by a career civil servant, not a political appointee. The rule establishing the new fire-at-will job category isn't final yet. It's still in the middle of a comment period. Plus, federal worker unions and their supporters have filed lawsuits challenging the proposed rule. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And the Justice Department is accusing some big health insurance companies of corrupting the semi-privatized part of Medicare, the government-funded health program for older and disabled people. In a complaint, government prosecutors allege the companies paid hundreds of millions of dollars in kickbacks to brokers to push patients into their Medicare Advantage plans. Among the accused, CVS Aetna, Humana, and Elevance Health. Companies plan what they say is a vigorous defense. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
System.